but I couldn't help myself. The wolf wins again.
Chapter 108.
We searched the place one more time and, over the threats of the daughter, started to take it apart, piece by piece. I had to say, the house was amazing, filled with antiques and artwork. Sandy thought that Aglionby might be trying to emulate the nearby La Fiorentina, which had been called the most beautiful house in the world. The banker certainly had expensive taste and could afford to indulge them. Hand-painted Louis XVI pieces were everywhere, as were Louis XV chandeliers, antique Turkish carpets, Chinese screens and panels, tapestries, paintings, classical and modern, on nearly every wall. Works by Fragonard, Goya, Bruegel. All of it financed by the wolf? Why not? He has over $2 billion to throw around. We assembled the suspects in the billiards room, which had 3 billiards tables and nearly as many plush sofas as the living room. The same tailored formality. Did anyone here know anything about the wolf? It didn't look that way to me. More likely, some of them might know Paris and Nicky Hilton. "Does anyone want to speak for the group?" the French police commander addressed them. No one volunteered. No one answered any questions. Either they didn't know or they had been told not to say.
"All right, then. Let's separate them. We'll begin the interviews now."
"Someone will talk," the commander warned. Since I hadn't been asked to participate in the interrogations, I wandered out onto the grounds and walked down toward the water. Had we been given another false lead to follow? The wolf's game playing, his strategies and counter-strategies had been relentless from the beginning. Why should it stop now? There was a large, actually very long, wooden boathouse at the water's edge. It stood maybe 100 yards from the main house. But what was this? Somebody had transformed the old boathouse into a garage to house a collection of more than 30 very expensive sports cars and luxury sedans. Maybe this was finally something. Evidence that the wolf might have used this estate. Or was it another ruse? A tease? I was standing between the boathouse and the water when all hell broke loose.
Chapter 109. All he had was his piece of the puzzle, his part in this terrible mission. But it was more than enough. Barry Nafis knew that there had been an incursion at the estate in Villefranche-sur-Mer, and that within the hour people would die because of it, including friends of his and one girl he'd slept with, a fashion model from Hamburg. Eye candy, to be sure, but very precious stuff. The French army and police had already taken over the mansion, and now it was Barry's turn to go to work, to do his job. He didn't know why this had to happen, only that it did. As he turned onto the D-125, it seemed to him that he was already too late. But he had his orders. Someone had obviously foreseen that this would happen. The wolf had known it was coming, hadn't he? He had eyes in the back of his head, eyes everywhere. What a scary bastard that one was. That was all that Barry Nafis knew, and all he cared about right now. He had been well paid in advance, even if this made little sense to him and was highly distasteful. Why kill and maim so many? Half an hour before, he'd received a radio signal from the main house. The noise had awakened him from a sound sleep in his hotel room. He jumped from bed, dressed, then hurried to a prearranged position on an estate to the north. He tried not to think about his friends and a lover inside the house. Maybe she would survive somehow. No matter. He wasn't going to cross the wolf over some girl. Barry ran through the woods and thick brush cover. He was carrying a man-portable air defense system, about as ungainly a weapon as there was. The missile launcher was 5 feet in length, a little over 35 pounds. Still, it was extremely well balanced and equipped with a rifle-style pistol grip and forestock. It fired an FIM-92A Stinger missile, and there were two other operators in the woods besides himself. Each of them had his little bit of work to do, his piece of the whole. Three professional killers on the move at that very moment, maybe feeling the same misgivings he had. A trap had been set for the police. A terrible death trap for everybody in that house. Police killed as well. What a mess. When he was in his final position, only about 1,500 feet from the main house, Barry hoisted the ungainly tube up onto his shoulder. He set his right hand on the pistol grip and sighted the weapon with his left. He held the launcher like a conventional rifle, though it was far from conventional. He easily found his target in the viewfinder. He could hardly miss hitting a house. Then he waited for a final command in his earphones. God, he didn't like this. He pictured the astonishingly pretty girl from Hamburg. Jerry was her name. So sweet, and what a perfect body. He waited, half hoping the signal wouldn't come. For Jerry's sake, for the sake of everyone inside. But there it was, electronic, impersonal as a stranger's funeral, a whistling sound between his ears, two short, one long. He took a deep breath, slowly exhaled. Then, reluctantly, he squeezed the trigger. Barry felt a slight recoil, less than a rifle's actually. The launch engine inside the weapon ignited. The first stage engine propelled the missile only about 20 to 30 feet, at which point it was safe for the secondary propulsion system to engage. His eyes followed a vapor trail of solid rocket fuel exhaust. The Stinger was on its way to the target. He heard a low roar as the missile accelerated to 1,500 miles per hour. Be safe, Jerry. The Stinger struck the estate broadside, a near-perfect hit. He was already reloading for the next shot.
Chapter 110. There were loud whooshing noises and then fiery, hellish explosions everywhere I looked. Chaos reigned everywhere, and death as well. French police and army personnel were frantically running for cover. A rocket or missile had struck the northern roofs of the villa, tossing slate, wood, and bricks from a chimney high into the air. Then a second missile struck. A third was only seconds behind. I had started racing back toward the main house when I got another surprise out of nowhere. A side door of the boathouse flew open, and a dark blue Mercedes sedan roared up a gravel path toward the main road. I ran to a police sedan parked on the grass, started it up, and gave chase. There wasn't time to tell anybody what I was doing, not even Sandy. I wondered how a police car was going to keep up with a souped-up Mercedes. Probably not too well. No, probably not at all. I stayed with the powerful CL-55 out of Cap Ferrat all the way to the Basse Corniche. I nearly killed myself and maybe a few others on the twisty road, but I didn't lose whoever was speeding in front of me. Who the hell was in the car? Why was somebody running? Could it be the wolf? Traffic toward Monaco was moving, but it was heavy. The lights from a tow truck up ahead indicated that some poor driver had jackknifed on this winding road. That was my one long-shot hope. The traffic was slowing down the bends. But suddenly the Mercedes swung around and headed west. The sports sedan was moving very fast past an endless array of billboards and restaurant signs. And so was I. I rounded a curve and the whole of the Bay of Villefranche-sur-Mer appeared in all of its inimitable beauty and splendor, the moon large and full in the sky. The city rose above the bay, which was filled with sailboats and yachts like a rich kid's bathtub. The Mercedes spun down a slick sloping hill, sometimes at a speed of 100 miles per hour. I thought I remembered from somewhere that the car had close to 500 horsepower. It sure seemed like it. Then we were entering the old port of Nice, and I began to close the gap behind the sedan.
The narrow streets were surprisingly crowded, especially around the bars and nightclubs, which seemed everywhere now, thank God. The Mercedes barely avoided a drunken group coming out of the Étoile Filon nightclub. And then, horn blaring, I roared through the same crowd, the pedestrians cursing and shaking fists at me. The Mercedes made a sharp right onto the N7, the Moyenne Corniche, a higher road. I followed as best I could, knowing that I would probably lose him now. Lose who, though? Who was in the blue Mercedes? The way up was incredibly steep and winding. We were headed back toward Monaco, but the traffic was light this way, and the Mercedes was effortlessly picking up speed. The driver had known to go backward in order to go forward, much faster, at a speed the police sedan couldn't possibly match. After about 2 kilometers, I was pretty sure I would lose him. We were back in Villefranche, but the highest part of town. The view down onto Cap Ferrat and Beaulieu was breathtaking, and I couldn't avoid looking. Even at this speed, it filled my eyes like a painting. I couldn't let him get away, and I pushed the police car up close to 100 again. How long could I possibly keep up? There was a tunnel, dimness, then almost total darkness. And at the end of the tunnel, the astonishing sight of a medieval village perched high on a hillside. Ayres read a sign, and I wished I could go EZ. Just past the village, the road became even more dangerous. It was as if the Moyenne Corniche were taped onto the side of the cliffs. Down below, the color of the sea seemed to be changing from azure to opal to silver gray. I could smell oranges and lemons in the air. My senses were sharp. Fear can do that. I was losing the Mercedes, though, so I made the only move I could. Instead of slowing around the next curve, I accelerated. Chapter 111. I began to gain on the Mercedes, and I kept my foot pressed to the floor. Are you suicidal? I wondered about myself. Suddenly, the Mercedes skidded all the way across the opposite lane. It struck the side of the mountain, a glancing blow, but very damaging to the car at that speed. Then it swerved back and forth on the road, across both lanes. It caromed off the rocks again. The blue sedan suddenly took off into the sky. It was airborne, falling toward the sea. I braked to the side of the road and jumped from my car. I saw the Mercedes hit the side of the cliff twice, then roll onto the lower highway far below. I couldn't get down there from where I was. Couldn't climb down anyway. I didn't see any movement from the wreck. Whoever was inside the Mercedes had to be dead. But who is it? I got back in the police car I had commandeered at the estate. It took me close to 10 minutes to make my way to the lower highway and the scene of the wreck. French police and an ambulance had already arrived, and so had many early morning onlookers. As I climbed from my car, I could see that the body hadn't been removed from the wreckage. Medical workers were leaning inside the car and seemed to be working frantically. They were talking to whoever had been driving. Who was it? One of them shouted,
"He's still alive! One male! He's alive in here!"
I started to run toward the wreckage to get a look at the driver. Who? Could he talk to me? I glanced back up at the Moyenne and wondered how the driver could have survived the long fall and crash. The Wolf was supposed to be a tough guy. This tough? I flashed my creds and the police surrounding the wreck let me move on. Then I could see. I knew who it was trapped in the wreck. I couldn't believe it, though. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing with my own eyes. My heart was thumping loudly, racing out of control. So was my mind, what was left of it. I came up to the smoldering, overturned car. I knelt on the rocky ground and leaned forward. "It's Alex," I said. The car's driver looked at me and tried to focus. His body was trapped inside the crumpled Mercedes. He'd been crushed by metal everywhere below the shoulders. Just awful to see. But Martin Lodge was alive, and he was hanging on. He seemed to want to say something, and I moved closer. "It's Alex," I said again. I turned my head so that my ear was near his mouth. I needed to know the identity of the Wolf. I had so many questions. Martin whispered, "It's all for nothing. Your manhunt is useless.
I'm not the wolf. I never even saw him.
Then he died on me, and everyone else who was waiting for an answer.
Chapter 112.
The Lodge family had been taken into protective custody back in England. We all felt that if the wolf suspected that the wife or any of the children had been told anything incriminating, they would be targets. Maybe he'd kill them just to be safe, or because he felt like killing somebody that day. The next morning, I flew to London and met with the police at Scotland Yard, specifically Lodge's superior, a man named John Mortensen. First, he reported that none of the survivors at Cap Ferrat seemed to know anything about the wolf, or even who Martin Lodge had been. "There's a new development, a little wrinkle," he told me then. I leaned back in a leather lounger with a view of Buckingham Palace. "At this point, I'm not surprised about anything, John. Tell me what's going on. This is about the Lodge family." He nodded, sighed, and then began. "It starts with Clara Lodge. Clara Chernohorska, actually. Let me begin with her. It turns out Martin was on the team that brought a defector named Edward Morozov out of Russia back in 93. Martin worked with the American CIA, with Cahill and Hancock, and also Thomas Weir. Only there was no Edward Morozov. He was an unidentified KGB defector whose name we don't know. We think that it was the Wolf. You started by saying something about Martin's wife, Clara. What about her? For one thing, she's not Czech. She came out of Russia with the man called Morozov. She was an assistant to a KGB chief and also our main source of information in Moscow. She and Lodge apparently got cozy during the transfer, and then she was relocated to England. He had her identity changed, got rid of the records. Then he married her. How about that? And she knows who the wolf is? What he looks like? Is that it? We don't know what Clara knows. She won't talk to us. She might talk to you, though. I sat back, shook my head. Why me? I met her only once. Mortensen shrugged. Then he gave a half smile. She says her husband trusted you. You believe that? What the hell is that supposed to mean? Why would she trust you if you met her only once? Unfortunately, I had no idea.
Chapter 113.
What remained of the Lodge family was being kept under wraps in a small town called Shepton Mallet, which was about 120 miles west of London. Rolling valleys, lots of green countryside, perfect for hiding them, at least temporarily. The Lodges were staying in a converted farmhouse on a no-through road outside of town. The land was fairly flat there, and anything approaching could be seen for miles. Besides, this was an armed compound, heavily armed. I arrived at about 6 that evening. The inside of the farmhouse was pleasant, with lots of antique furniture, but I had dinner with the family in a cramped bunker that was located below ground. Clara didn't cook the meal as she had in London, and I wondered if she approved of the fare. I doubted it. The food was dreadful, worse than airplane fare. "No Michana Vetsa on the menu," I finally tried as a joke for her.
"You remember our breakfast in Battersea? Even the correct pronunciation."
"That's good, Alex," Clara said.
"You're very observant. Martin said you were a good cop."
When the meal was over, the children, Hannah, Daniela, Joseph, were sent to their room to do homework. Clara sat with me and smoked a cigarette. She took long puffs and inhaled deeply. "Homework?" I asked. "Here? Tonight?"
"It's good to have discipline. Habits to fall back on. I think it is." "So you were with Martin when he died?" she asked. "What did he say to you? Please tell me."
I considered my response.
What did Clara want to hear? And what should I tell her? He said that he wasn't the wolf. Is that true, Clara?
Anything else? What else did he tell you?
I thought about telling Clara he'd talked about her and the children, but I didn't. I didn't want to lie to her. Probably I couldn't. No, Clara, that's all it was. There wasn't much time, only a few seconds. He didn't suffer too long. He didn't seem to be in pain. I think he was in shock. She nodded.
Martin thought I could trust you. He said it was your flaw, actually. He would never say anything sentimental, not even with his dying breath.
I stared into Clara's deep brown eyes, which seemed surprisingly alert. How do you feel about that? I asked.
She laughed. It's why I loved him.
She had things to tell me that night in the English countryside. A negotiation was begun between the two of us, or rather, I got to listen to her demands.
I want safe passage out of England for myself and the children. New identities, and we get to keep some savings to live on. I'll tell you where we want to live, but not right now. That will come a little later.
Prague? I asked. It was a small joke.
No, definitely not Prague, Alex. And not Russia, either. Or anywhere in America, for that matter. I'll tell you where when the time comes. But first, let's decide on what I have to give you to guarantee our safe passage out of England.
Oh, that's easy. You have to give us a lot, I said. You have to give up the wolf. But can you do that, Clara? What do you know? Who is he? Where is he? What did Martin tell you? Finally, she smiled.
Oh, he told me everything. Martin adored me.
Chapter 114.
The wolf flew his own plane into Teterboro Airport in the northern corner of New Jersey. A black Range Rover was waiting there for him, and he took it into New York City, a city he'd always despised. The traffic was bad, as usual, and it took him as long to get from Teterboro to Manhattan as it had to fly to the metropolitan area from New Hampshire. The doctor's office was situated in a brownstone on 63rd Street, just off 5th. The wolf parked the Range Rover and hurried inside. It was a little past 9 in the morning. He didn't bother to check if he was being watched. He didn't think so, but if he was, there was nothing he could do about it now. Besides, he felt he had this morning sufficiently covered. As usual, there was a plan for every eventuality. The nurse on duty for the plastic surgery was also there to act as a receptionist. She and the hotshot surgeon would be the only ones present for the procedures. He had insisted on a staff of 2 and that the office be closed to other patients for the day. "There are a few legal forms for you to look over and sign," the nurse told him with a tight smile. She might not have known who he was, but she suspected there had to be a very good reason for this much secrecy, not to mention that she was being paid handsomely to work this shift. "No, I will sign nothing, thank you," he said, then pushed past her and went looking for Dr. Levine. He found her in a small operating theater that was already brightly lit and very cold. "It reminds me of Siberia, a gulag I spent time in one winter," he said. The doctor turned, and she was mildly attractive, slender, well-preserved, probably in her early 40s. He could fuck her in a pinch, but he wasn't in the mood right then. Maybe later. "Dr. Levine," he said, and shook hands with the surgeon. "I'm ready, and I don't want to be here more than a few hours, so let's begin, now." "That's not possible," Dr. Levine started to object. The wolf raised his hand to silence her, and it almost seemed as if he might actually strike the doctor. She flinched. "I won't be needing a general anesthesia. As I said, I'm ready. So are you." "Sir, You have no idea what you're saying. None, I assure you. The procedures we have scheduled include a face, neck, and brow lift, liposuction, jaw and cheek implants, and a nose job. The pain will be unbearable. Trust me on that. No, it will be bearable. I've known much worse pain. I will allow you only to monitor my vital statistics. There will be no more stupid discussion about anesthesia. Now, get me ready for the procedures. Or else. Or else what? Dr. Levine bristled. The small woman rocked back on her heels. Just or else, answered the wolf. That covers a great deal of territory, don't you think? It covers pain beyond what you believe I cannot endure. Can you, Dr. Levine? Can your two children, Martin and Amy, endure such pain? Or your husband, Gerald? Let's begin. I have a schedule to keep. Always a schedule. And a plan.
Chapter 115.
He never once screamed, never made a sound during any of the grueling procedures, and neither the surgeon nor the nurse could comprehend what they were witnessing. The patient seemed to have no feeling at all. As males often do, he bled a great deal during the operations, and there was already a lot of deep purple bruising on his face. The pain he endured during the hour and a half rhinoplasty, or nose job, was the worst by far, especially when large chunks of bone and cartilage were removed without even a topical anesthetic. At the conclusion of the rhinoplasty, the final procedure, he was told by Dr. Levine not to stand, but he did anyway. His neck felt tight and tender, and there was betadine all over his scalp and throat.
Not bad, he rasped. I've experienced much worse.
Do not blow your nose, for at least a week, the doctor insisted, seemingly trying to maintain her dignity and a tenuous sense of control. The wolf reached into his trousers and produced a handkerchief, but then put it back.
Just kidding, he said, then frowned.
Do you have any sense of humor, doctor?
You can't drive either, said the doctor. That I will not allow, for the sake of others.
No, of course not. I wouldn't think of it, putting others in jeopardy. I'll just leave my vehicle here on the street to be carjacked. Let me get you your money. It's becoming boring to be here with you.
It was then, as he walked to fetch his briefcase, that the Russian staggered slightly, and also got the first look at himself in a mirror, his incredibly bruised and swollen face, at least what showed around the bandages.
You'll do nice work, he said, and laughed.
He opened the briefcase and pulled out a Beretta with silencer. He shot the astonished nurse in the face twice, then turned to Dr. Levine, who had hurt him so much.
Any other things I should or shouldn't do? Any last bits of advice you wish to impart?
My children, please, don't kill me. You know I have children.
They'll be better off without you. I think so, bitch. I bet they would agree.
He shot her through the heart. A mercy killing, he thought to himself, especially after the way she'd tortured him. Plus, he just didn't like her, the humorless bitch. Finally, the wolf left the office and walked to his Range Rover. He was thinking that no one knew what he looked like now, not a single person anywhere. And that got him laughing, almost uncontrollably. This was his piece of the puzzle.
Chapter 116.
There he is. Has to be.
He's laughing. What's so funny? Look at him. Can you believe it?
He looks like he was scalped, then had his skin flayed, Ned Mahoney said, when the heavily bandaged man in a gray overcoat emerged from the brownstone. He looks like a goddamn ghoul.
Don't underestimate him, I reminded Ned. And don't forget, he is a ghoul. We were watching the wolf. At least the man we believed to be the wolf, as he left a plastic surgeon's office on the east side of Manhattan. We had just gotten there less than 60 seconds before. Almost missed him again.
Don't worry, I'm not underestimating him, Alex. That's why we have half a dozen teams getting ready to pounce on him. If we'd gotten here sooner, we could have grabbed him inside the doctor's office.
I nodded. At least we're here. It was a complicated negotiation in England. Clara Lodge and her children are somewhere in northern Africa now. She did her part.
So the wolf has had a tracking device under his shoulder blade since he came out of Russia? That's the story?
We're here, aren't we? According to Clara, Martin Lodge knew where he was all along.
That kept Lodge alive. We're ready to go then? We take him?
We're ready. I'm ready.
Jesus, was I ready. I wanted to take this bastard down so badly, I couldn't wait to see the look on his face.
Mahoney spoke into the mic attached to his headset.
Close on him now. And remember, he's extremely dangerous.
You got that right, Netto.
Chapter 117.
The black Range Rover was stopped at a light on the corner of 5th Avenue and 59th Street. Dark sedans pulled up on both sides. A third car blocked off the intersection. Agents jumped out of the cars. We had him. Gunfire suddenly erupted from a white Hummer in front of the Range Rover. The doors of the Hummer flew open. Three men with automatic weapons came out firing.
Where the hell did they come from? Mahoney yelled into his mic. Everybody down!
We were already out of our car and running toward the gunfight. Ned fired and took down one of the wolf's bodyguards. I hit another and a third bodyguard opened up on us. Meanwhile, the wolf was out of the Range Rover and running down Fifth Avenue, staying out in the street with the cars. The condition of his face made him look as though he'd already been shot, or maybe badly burned in a fire. People on the sidewalk were hitting the pavement because of the gunshots coming from everywhere. Several were screaming uncontrollably. How far did the wolf think he could get, looking the way he did? In New York City? Maybe far. More gunmen appeared, seemingly out of nowhere. More of his bodyguards. He had certainly brought backup. Had we brought enough? And then the wolf ducked into a store on Fifth. Mahoney and I followed him. I didn't even notice what store it was. Upscale, glitzy, Fifth Avenue, for God's sake. The wolf did the unthinkable then. Although nothing he did completely surprised me anymore. His right arm shot forward and released a dark object into the air. I watched it start to tumble. I shouted, "Grenade! Everybody down! Get down! Grenade!" A powerful explosion at the front of the store blew out two massive picture windows. Shoppers were hurt. The smoke was very thick and dark. Everybody inside the store was screaming, including the clerks behind nearly every counter. I never lost sight of the wolf, never lost my focus on him. No matter what he did, no matter what the danger, he couldn't be allowed to get away this time. The cost was too high. This was the man who had held the world hostage. He'd already murdered thousands. Mahoney ran down one aisle and I took another. The wolf appeared to be headed for an exit onto a side street. I'd lost track of where we were. 55th Street? 56th?
He doesn't get out, Ned shouted over to me. You've got that right, I shouted back.
We were getting closer and I could see the wolf's face. With all the bandages, the bruising and swelling, he looked fiercer than I could have imagined. Worse, he looked desperate, capable of anything. But we already knew that. He yelled,
I'll kill everybody in the store.
Neither Mahoney nor I answered. We just kept coming. But we didn't doubt what he'd said. He grabbed a small blonde girl away from what looked to be a nanny.
I'll kill her. I'll kill the little girl. She's dead. I'll kill her.
We kept coming. He held the toddler against his chest. His blood was dripping all over her. The girl was screaming, squirming wildly in his arms.
I'll kill...
Ned and I fired at almost the same time. Two shots, and the wolf stumbled backward, letting go of the girl. She fell to the floor, then got up screeching and ran to safety. So did the wolf. Out the nearest side door and onto the street.
He's wearing a vest. Has to be. We'll shoot him in the head, I said.
Chapter 118.
We chased him east on 55th Street, along with a couple of our agents and two fleet-footed New York City policemen. If any of the Wolf's bodyguards had survived the bloody shootout on Fifth Avenue, they'd lost track of their boss in the shuffle inside the store. They were nowhere to be seen now. Still, the Wolf looked as though he knew where he was going. Was that possible? How could he have planned for this? He probably couldn't have, so we'd get him now, right? I couldn't let myself believe otherwise, that all of this could come to nothing. We had him in our sights. He was right there in front of us. Suddenly, he turned into a building, red brick, 8 to 10 stories high. Did he know someone there? More backup? A trap? What? There was security inside. At least there had been. But the uniformed guard was dead now, shot in the head, lying face down and bleeding on the glossy marble floor. The elevators were all busy, red lights flashing the floors, 8, 4, 3, all going up. He's not getting out of here. That's settled, Mahoney said. We can't know that, Ned. He can't fucking fly, can he? No, but who the hell knows what else he can do? He came in here for a reason. Mahoney assigned agents to wait for all of the elevators, then to systematically check the floors from bottom to top. Reinforcements were on the way from the NYPD. There would be dozens of cops here soon, then hundreds. The Wolf was in the building. Mahoney and I took to the stairs in pursuit. Where do we go? How far? The roof. It's the only way out of here. You really think he's got a plan? How, Alex? I shook my head. I had no way of knowing. He was bleeding. Had to be weak. Maybe he was even delirious. Or maybe he had a plan. Hell, he'd always had a plan before. So up we went. All the way. The top floor was 9, and we didn't see the Wolf as we peeked out of the stairwell. We quickly checked the offices. No one had seen him, and they sure would have remembered if they had. In the back, there's stairs up to the roof, someone told us in a law office. Ned Mahoney and I climbed more stairs. Then we stepped outside into bright daylight. We didn't see the Wolf. There was a single-story structure like a small hat on top of the old building. Water tower? The super's office? We tried the door. It was locked. He has to be here somewhere. Unless he jumped, Ned said. Then we saw him coming around from behind the tower.
I didn't jump, Mr. Mahoney, and I thought I told you not to work on this case. I think I was clear. Put down your guns right now.
I stepped forward. I brought him here.
Of course you did. You're the indefatigable, don't give up, relentless Dr. Cross. That's why you're so predictable and useful.
Suddenly, a New York City policeman stepped out of the same trapdoor opening to the roof that we had used. He saw the Wolf and fired. He hit the Wolf in the chest, but it didn't stop him. He was wearing a vest, had to be. The Russian growled like a bear and charged the cop, waving both arms over his head. He grabbed the surprised officer and picked him up. There was nothing Ned or I could do. Next thing, he hurled the man off the roof. The Wolf started to race toward the other side of the rooftop, and he seemed genuinely insane. What was he doing? Suddenly, I thought I knew. The building to the south was close enough that he was going to jump for it. Then, coming in from the west, I saw a helicopter. For him? Was that the escape plan? Don't let this be happening. I ran after him. So did Mahoney. Stop! Stop right there! He was running in crazy zigzags away from us. We fired but didn't hit him with the first shots. Then the Wolf was airborne, both his arms flailing, and he was going to make it to the other rooftop with room to spare. You bastard, no! Ned yelled. No! I stopped running, aimed carefully, and squeezed the trigger 4 times.
Chapter 119.
The Wolf kept pumping his legs and seemed almost to be running on thin air. But then he started to drop. His arms reached out toward the edge of the other building. His fingers reached for the roof. Mahoney and I ran up to the edge of our building. Could the Wolf get out of this one? Somehow he always found a way. Except this time. I knew I'd hit him in the throat. He had to be drowning in his own blood. Fall, you fuck! Ned screamed at him. He's not gonna make it, I said. And he didn't. The Russian's body fell, and strangely he didn't fight it. Didn't make a sound, never screamed out. Not a sound came from him. Mahoney yelled down at him, Hey, Wolf! Hey, Wolfman! Go to hell! The fall looked as if it had been shot in slow motion, but then he hit the ground in the alleyway between the buildings. Hit it hard. I stared down at the wolf's mangled body, the bandaged face, and I felt satisfied for the first time in a long while. I felt fulfilled and whole. We'd gotten him, and he deserved to die like that, squashed like a bug on the pavement. Then Ned Mahoney started to clap and whoop and dance around like a complete madman. I didn't join in, but I knew what he was feeling. The man down there deserved this fate, if anyone ever did. Stone cold dead in an alleyway. He didn't scream, I finally said. Couldn't even give us that. Mahoney shrugged his wide shoulders. I don't care if he did or not. Here we are up here, there he is down with the garbage. Maybe there's some justice after all. Well, maybe not, Ned said, and laughed, putting his arm around me and squeezing. We won, I said to him. Damn it. We finally won, Neddy. Chapter 120. We won. The next morning, I flew back to Quantico in a Bell helicopter with Ned Mahoney and some of his stellar crew. They were celebrating the Wolf's demise at HRT over in Quantico, but I wanted to get home. I'd told Nana to keep the kids away from school because we were celebrating. We won. I let myself decompress for some of the car ride from Quantico to Washington. When I finally got to the house, when I could see it up ahead, I started to feel closer to normal, almost myself, or at least somebody I recognized. No one had come out onto the porch yet, so Nana and the kids hadn't seen me arrive. I decided to surprise them. We won! The front door wasn't locked, and I went inside. A few lights were on, but I didn't see anybody yet. Maybe they're going to surprise me. Keeping very quiet, I made my way back to the kitchen. The lights were on. Plates and silverware had been laid out for lunch, but nobody was there either. Kind of strange. Just a little bit off kilter. Rosie the cat came meowing from somewhere, rubbing up against me. Finally, I called out, I'm home! Your daddy's home. Where is everybody? I'm home from the wars. I hurried upstairs, but nobody was there. I checked for notes that might have been left for me. Nothing. I ran downstairs. I looked out back, then up and down Fifth Street in front of the house. Not a soul in sight anywhere. Where were Nana and the kids? They knew I was coming. I went back inside and made a few phone calls to places Nana and the kids might be. But Nana almost always left a note when she went out with the kids, even for an hour or so, and they'd been expecting me. Suddenly, I felt sick. I waited another half an hour before I contacted some people at the Hoover Building, starting with Tony Woods in the director's office. In the meantime, I'd looked around the house again, found no sign of any kind of disturbance. A team of technical people arrived, and shortly afterward, one of them approached me in the kitchen. There are footprints out in the yard, probably male. Some dirt was recently tracked into the house. Could have been repairmen or a delivery service, but it's definitely fresh. That was all they found that afternoon. Not another clue. Not one. Samson and Billy came over in the evening, and we sat together and waited, at least for a call, something to go on. Something to give me hope. But no call came, and sometime after 2 in the morning, Samson finally went home. Billy had left about 10. I stayed up all night, but nothing. No contact. No word at all about Nana and the kids. I talked to Jamila on my cell phone and it helped, but not enough. Nothing could have helped that night. Finally, early in the morning, I stood at the front door, bleary-eyed, and stared up and down the street. It occurred to me that this had always been my worst fear. Maybe everybody's worst fear. To be all alone with nobody. And to have those you love the most in terrible danger. We lost. Chapter 121. The email came on the fifth day. I almost couldn't bear to read it. I thought that I might throw up as I stared down at the words.
Alex, I read. Surprise, dear boy. I am actually not as cruel or heartless a person as you might think I am. The really cruel ones, the truly unreasonable ones, the ones we should all fear, are mostly in your own United States and in Western Europe. The money I have now will help stop them, help stop their greed. Do you believe that? You should. Why not? Why the hell not? I thank you for what you did for me and for Hannah, Daniela, and Joseph. We owe you something and I pay my debts. To me, you are a gnat, but at least you are a gnat. Your family will be returned today, but now we're even. You will never see me again. I don't want to see you either. If I do, you will die. That is a promise. Signed, Clara Czernohorska. Wolf.
Chapter 122. I couldn't let it go. Couldn't and wouldn't. The wolf had invaded my house, taken my family, even though they had been returned unharmed. It could happen again. Over the next few weeks, I tested, then strained, the new cooperative relationship between the Bureau and the CIA. I got Ron Burns to put even more stress on the situation. I traveled out to CIA headquarters in Langley more than a dozen times, talked to everybody from junior analysts to the new director, James Dowd. I wanted to know about Thomas Weir and the KGB agent he'd helped bring out of Russia. I needed to know everything that they knew. Was that possible? I doubted it, but that didn't stop me from trying. Then one day I was called up to Burns's office. When I arrived, I found Burns and the new CIA director waiting for me in his conference room. Something was up. This was going to be good or very, very bad. Come on in, Alex, said Burns, cordial as he often was. We need to talk. I stepped inside and sat across from the two heavies, both in shirt tails, looking as if they had just come out of a long and difficult work session. About what? The wolf? Something else that I didn't want to hear about? Director Dowd wants to say a few things to you, said Burns. I do, Alex, said Dowd, a New York lawyer who had been an unexpected choice for CIA director. He had started in the New York Police Department, then gone into a lucrative private practice for several years. According to rumors, there were things that none of us knew or wanted to know about Dowd and his years in private practice. I'm just finding my way around at Langley, he said, and actually, this exercise has helped. We've spent a great deal of time and effort digging into everything about Director Weir. Dowd looked over at Burns. Just about all of it is good. An excellent record of service. But this kind of digging into old records isn't appreciated by some of the old warrior types out in Virginia. Frankly, I don't give a shit what they think. A Russian by the name of Anton Krishchikov was recruited and then brought out of Russia in 1990. This man was the wolf. We're fairly sure about that. He was transported to England, where he met with a few agents, including Martin Lodge. Then he was moved to a house outside Washington. His identity was known only to a handful of people. Most of them are dead now, including Weir. Finally, he was moved to a city of his choosing, Paris, where he met up with his family, mother and father, wife, two young sons, ages 9 and 12. Alex, they lived two blocks from the Louvre, on one of the streets that was destroyed a few weeks ago. His entire family was killed there in 94, but not Khrushchev himself. We believe the attack may have been orchestrated by the Russian government. We don't know for certain, but somebody leaked where he was living to somebody who didn't want him to continue living. The attack may have taken place on the bridge across the Seine that was destroyed. He blamed the CIA and Tom Weir, Byrne said, and he blamed the governments that were involved. Maybe he went mad after that. Who the hell knows? He joined the mafia and rose quickly. Here in America, probably in New York. Byrne stopped. Dow didn't add anything more. They were both looking at me. So it's not Clara. What else do we know about Khrushchev? Dowd raised his hands with both palms up. There are notes in our records, but precious few. He was known by some mafia leaders, but they seem to be dead now, too. Maybe the current mafia big man in Brooklyn knows something. There's another possible contact in Paris. We're working a couple of angles in Moscow. I shook my head. I don't care how long it takes. I want him. Tell me everything there is. He was close to his sons. Maybe that's why he spared your family, Alex, said Burns. And mine. He spared my family to show how powerful he is, how superior to the rest of us. He squeezes a rubber ball, said Dowd. A handball. Black. I didn't follow at first. I'm sorry, what? One of his sons gave him a rubber handball before the boy died. A birthday present. In one of the notes we have, it says that Khrushchev squeezes the ball when he gets angry. He's also said to favor beards. He's celibate now, according to the rumors anyway. It's all pieces, Alex. That's what we have. I'm sorry. So was I. But it didn't matter. I was going to get him. He squeezes a rubber ball. He favors beards. His family was murdered. Chapter 123. 6 weeks later, I traveled to New York, my fifth out-of-town trip in a row. Tolyubikov had been at or near the top of the Red Mafia gangs in New York, specifically the Brighton Beach area, for the past few years. He had been a mafia head in Moscow and was the most powerful leader to come to America. I was going to see him. On a sunny, unseasonably warm day, Ned Mahoney and I made the journey out to Mill Neck on Long Island's Gold Coast. The area we drove through was heavily wooded, served by narrow roads with no sidewalks anywhere. We arrived at the Bykov compound with a dozen agents, unannounced. We had a warrant. There were bodyguards posted everywhere, and I wondered how Tolyubikov could live like this. Maybe because he had to in order to remain alive. The house itself was very large, a three-story colonial. It had incredible water views across the Sound all the way to Connecticut. There was a gunite pool with a waterfall, a boathouse, and a dock. The wages of sin? Bykov was waiting in his den for our talk. I was surprised at how tired, how old he looked. He had small, beady eyes and a pocked face rolling with fat. He was grossly overweight, probably close to 300 pounds. His breathing was labored and he had a hacking cough. I'd been told that he spoke no English. I want to know about the man called the Wolf, I said as I sat down across from him at a plain wooden table. One of our agents from the New York office translated, a young Russian-American. Tolyubikov scratched the back of his neck, then shook his head back and forth, finally muttering several Russian words between a clenched jaw. The translator listened, then looked at me.
He says you're wasting his time and yours. Why don't you leave right now? He knows Peter and the wolf. No other wolves.
We're not going to leave. The FBI, the CIA, we're going to be in Mr. Bykov's face, in his business, until we find the wolf. Tell him that. The agent spoke in Russian, and Bykov laughed in his face. The Russian said something, and the sentences mentioned Chris Rock.
He says you're funnier than Chris Rock. He likes Chris Rock. Political comedians in general.
I stood up, nodded to Bykov, then walked out of the room. I didn't expect too much more from the first meeting, just an introduction. I would be back again and again if necessary. This was the only case I was working now. I was learning to be patient. Very patient.
Chapter 124.
Minutes later, I was leaving the large house, walking side by side with Ned Mahoney. We were laughing about the first interview. What the hell? Might as well laugh. I saw something and did a double take. Saw it again. Ned, Jesus, look! What? His head swiveled around, but he didn't see what I saw. Then I was running ahead on legs that felt unsteady. What? Alex, what is it? Ned yelled behind me. Alex! It's him, I said. My eyes were pinned on one of the bodyguard types at the compound. Black suit jacket and shirt, no overcoat. He was standing under a large evergreen, watching us watch him. My eyes dropped to his hand. In the hand, a black ball, an old one. He was squeezing it, and I knew. I just knew. It had to be the handball given to the wolf by his small son before he died. The man with the ball had a beard. His eyes looked at mine. Then he started to run. I yelled back at Ned, "That's him! He's the wolf!" I sprinted across the lawn, moving faster than I had in a while. I trusted that Ned was behind me. I saw the Russian man jump into a bright red convertible. Then he started it up. Oh no, God no, I thought. But I tumbled into the front seat before he put it into gear. I hit him with a short, powerful punch to the nose. Blood gushed all over his black shirt and jacket. I knew I'd broken his nose. I hit him again, square on the jaw. I shoved open the driver's side door. He looked at me, and his eyes were coldly intelligent, like no eyes I'd ever seen. Nothing so desolate. Inhuman. That was what the French president had called him. Was he the real Tolya Bykov? It didn't matter to me now. He was the wolf. I could see it in those eyes, the confidence, arrogance, but most of all, the hatred for me and everyone else.
The ball. You knew about the ball. My son gave it to me. I congratulate you.
He gave a strange half-smile, then bit down hard on something inside his mouth. I thought I knew what had happened. I tried desperately to force open his mouth. His jaw was clamped tightly shut, and suddenly the Russian's eyes were wide, incredibly big and full of pain. Poison. He'd bitten into poison. Then his mouth opened, and he roared, full voice. White foam and spit ran over his lips and down his chin. He roared again, and his body began to convulse. I couldn't hold him down any longer. I pushed myself up, backed away from his flopping body. He began to gag and to claw at his throat. The convulsing, the dying went on for several awful minutes. And there was nothing I could do and nothing I wanted to do except watch. And then it happened. The wolf died in the front seat of the convertible, another of his expensive cars. When it was over, I bent and picked up the rubber handball. I put it in my pocket. It was what killers I've caught call a trophy. It was over, and I was going home, wasn't I? I had things to think about, and so much to change about my life. I had the uncomfortable thought, I'm taking trophies now too. But I had another, much more important thought. Damon, Jenny, little Alex, Nana.
home. The wolf is dead. I saw him die. I kept telling myself that until I finally believed it.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of London Bridges, written by James Patterson and read by Peter J. Fernandez and Dennis O'Hare. Executive producer, Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. Production supervised by Dennis Kao. London Bridges is also available in hardcover from Little Brown and Company. To listen to samples or read more about the author, please visit Time Warner Audiobooks website at twbookmark.com/audiobooks. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.